Chapter 81. Little Mary Clapp, the landlord's daughter, who actually caught the disease of little Georgie. Truth compels one to say, no. They slept quite undisturbed, at least as far as she was concerned, pronounced hers to be a slight case, which would almost cure itself, sent her in a draft or two, and threw in bark when the child rallied, with perfect indifference, and just for form's sake. Again, there was the little French chevalier opposite, who gave lessons in his native tongue at various schools in the neighborhood, and who might be heard in his apartment of nights playing tremulous old gavottes and minuets on a wheezy old fiddle. Whenever this powdered and courteous old man, who never missed a Sunday at the convent chapel at Hammersmith, and who was in all respects, thoughts, conduct, and bearing utterly unlike the bearded savages of his nation, who curse perfidious Albion, and scowl at you from over their cigars, in the quadrant arcades at the present day, whenever the old chevalier de Talonrouche spoke of Mistress Osborne, he would first finish his pinch of snuff, flick away the remaining particles of dust with a graceful wave of his hand, gather up his fingers again into a bunch, and, bringing them up to his mouth, blow them open with a kiss, exclaiming, ah, la, divine creature. He vowed and protested that, when Amelia walked in the Brompton Lanes, flowers grew in profusion under her feet. He called little Georgie Cupid, and asked him news of Venus, his mama, and told the astonished Betty Flanagan that she was one of the graces, and the favorite attendant of the Rhine des Amours. Instances might be multiplied of this easily gained and unconscious popularity. Did not Mr. Binney, the mild and genteel curate of the district chapel, which the family attended, call assiduously upon the widow, dandle the little boy on his knee, and offer to teach him Latin, to the anger of the elderly virgin, his sister, who kept house for him? Tea there is nothing in her, Bilby, the latter lady would say. When she comes to tea here, she does not speak a word during the whole evening. She is but a poor lackadaisical creature, and it is my belief has no heart at all. It is only her pretty face which all you gentlemen admire so. Miss Gritz, who has £5,000, and expectations besides, has twice as much character, and is 1,000 times more agreeable to my taste, and if she were good-looking I know that you would think her perfection. Very likely Miss Binney was right to a great extent. It is the pretty face which creates sympathy in the hearts of men, those wicked rogues. A woman may possess the wisdom and chastity of Minerva, and we give no heed to her, if she has a plain face. What folly will not a pair of bright eyes make pardonable? What dullness may not red lips and sweet accents render pleasant? And so, with their usual sense of justice, ladies argue that, because a woman is handsome, therefore she is a fool. Oh, ladies, ladies! There are some of you who are neither handsome nor wise. These are but trivial incidents to recount in the life of our heroine. Her tale does not deal in wonders, as the gentle reader has already no doubt perceived. And if a journal had been kept of her proceedings during the 7 years after the birth of her son, there would be found few incidents more remarkable in it than that of the measles, recorded in the foregoing page. Yes, one day, and greatly to her wonder, the Reverend Mr. Binney, just mentioned, asked her to change her name of Osborne for his own, when, with deep blushes and tears in her eyes and voice, she thanked him for his regard for her, expressed gratitude for his attentions to her, and to her poor little boy, but said that she never, never could think of any, but the husband whom he had lost. On the 25th of April, and the 18th of June, the days of marriage and widowhood, she kept her room entirely, consecrating them, and we do not know how many hours of solitary night thought, her little boy sleeping in his crib by her bedside, to the memory of that departed friend. During the day she was more active, as he had to teach George to read, and to write, and a little to draw. She read books, in order that she might tell him stories from them. As his eyes opened and his mind expanded under the influence of the outward nature round about him, she taught the child, to the best of her humble power, to acknowledge the Maker of all, and every night and every morning he and she in that awful and touching communion which I think must bring a thrill to the heart of every man who witnesses, or who remembers it. The mother and the little boy prayed to our Father together, the mother pleading with all her gentle heart, the child lisping after her as she spoke. And each time they prayed to God to bless dear Papa, as if he were alive, and in the room with them. To wash and dress this young gentleman, to take him for a run of the mornings, before breakfast, and the retreat of Grandpapa for usiness, to make for him the most wonderful and ingenious dresses, for which end the thrifty widow cut up, and altered every available little bit of finery which she possessed out of her wardrobe during her marriage for Mrs. Osborne herself, greatly to her mother's vexation, who preferred fine clothes, especially since her misfortunes, always wore a black gown, and a straw bonnet with a black ribbon occupied her many hours of the day. Others as he had to spare, at the service of her mother and her old father, as he had taken the pains to learn, and used to play cribbage with this gentleman on the nights, when he did not go to his club. She sang for him, when he was so minded, and it was a good sign, for he invariably fell into a comfortable sleep during the music. She wrote out his numerous memorials, letters, prospectuses, and projects. It was in her handwriting that most of the old gentleman's former acquaintances were informed that he had become an agent for the Black Diamond and Anti-Cinder Coal Company, and could supply his friends and the public with the best coals at Esperchaldron. All he did was to sign the circulars with his flourish and signature, and direct them in a shaky, clerk-like hand. One of these papers was sent to Major Dobbin, Rect. Care of Messrs. Cox and Greenwood, but the major being in Madras at the time, had no particular call for coals. He knew, though, the hand which had written the prospectus. Good God! What would he not have given to hold it in his own? A second prospectus came out, informing the major that J. Sedley and Company, having established agencies at Oporto, Bordeaux, and St. Mary's, were enabled to offer to their friends, and the public generally the finest, and most celebrated growths of ports, sherries, and claret wines at reasonable prices, and under extraordinary advantages. Acting upon this hint, Dobbin furiously canvassed the governor, the commander-in-chief, the judges, the regiments, and everybody whom he knew in the presidency, and sent home to Sedley and Company orders for wine which perfectly astonished Mr. Sedley and Mr. Clapp, who was the company in the business. But no more orders came after that first burst of good fortune, on which poor old Sedley was about to build a house in the city, a regiment of clerks, a dock to himself, and correspondents all over the world. The old gentleman's former taste in wine had gone. The curses of the messroom assailed Major Dobbin for the vile drinks he had been the means of introducing there, and he bought back a great quantity of the wine, and sold it at public outcry, at an enormous loss to himself. As for Joes, who was by this time promoted to a seat at the Revenue Board at Calcutta, he was wild with rage, when the post brought him out a bundle of these bacchanalian prospectuses, with a private note from his father, telling Joes that his senior counted upon him in this enterprise, and had consigned a quantity of select wines to him, as per invoice, drawing bills upon him for the amount of the same. Joes, who would no more have it supposed that his father, Joe Sedley's father, of the Board of Revenue, was a wine merchant asking for orders, than that he was Jack Ketch, refused the bills with scorn, wrote back contumeliously to the old gentleman, bidding him to mind his own affairs, and the protested paper coming back, Sedley and Company had to take it up, with the profits which they had made out of the Madras venture, and with a little portion of Emmy's savings. Besides her pension of £50 a year, there had been £500, as her husband's executor stated, left in the agent's hands at the time of Osborne's demise, which sum, as George's guardian, Dobbin proposed to put out at 8% in an Indian house of agency. Mr. Sedley, who thought the major had some roguish intentions of his own about the money, was strongly against this plan, and he went to the agents to protest personally against the employment of the money in question. When he learned, to his surprise, that there had been no such sum in their hands, that all the late captain's assets did not amount to £100, and that the £500 in question must be a separate sum, of which Major Dobbin knew the particulars. More than ever convinced that there was some roguery, old Sedley pursued the major. As his daughter's nearest friend, he demanded with a high hand a statement of the late captain's accounts. Dobbin, stammering, blushing, and awkwardness added to the other's convictions that he had a rogue to deal with, and in a majestic tone he told that officer a piece of his mind, as he called it, simply stating his belief that the major was unlawfully detaining his late son-in-law's money. Dobbin at this lost all patience, and if his accuser had not been so old and so broken, a quarrel might have ensued between them at the Slaughter's coffee house, in a box of which place of entertainment the gentlemen had their colloquy. "Home upstairs, sir," lisped out the major. "Insist on your coming up the stairs, and I will show which is the injured party, poor George or I," and, dragging the old gentleman up to his bedroom, he produced from his desk Osborne's accounts, and a bundle of IOUs which the latter had given, who, to do him justice, was always ready to give an IOU. "He paid his bills in England," Dobbin added, "but he had not £100 in the world when he fell. I and one or two of his brother officers made up the little sum, which was all that we could spare, and you dare tell us that we are trying to cheat the widow and the orphan." Sedley was very contrite and humbled, though the fact is that William Dobbin had told a great falsehood to the old gentleman, having himself given every shilling of the money, having buried his friend, and paid all the fees and charges incident upon the calamity and removal of poor Amelia. About these expenses old Osborne had never given himself any trouble to think, nor any other relative of Amelia, nor Amelia herself, indeed. She trusted to Major Dobbin as an accountant, took his somewhat confused calculations for granted, and never once suspected how much she was in his debt. Twice or thrice in the year, according to her promise, she wrote him letters to Madras, letters all about little Georgie. How he treasured these papers! Whenever Amelia wrote, he answered, and not until then. But he sent over endless remembrances of himself to his godson and to her. He ordered and sent a box of scarfs, and a grand ivory set of chessmen from China. The pawns were little green and white men, with real swords and shields. The knights were on horseback. The castles were on the backs of elephants. Mrs. Mango's own set at the Pineries was not so fine, Mr. Pessler remarked. These chessmen were the delight of Georgie's life, who printed his first letter in acknowledgement of this gift of his godpapa. He sent over preserves and pickles, which latter the young gentleman tried surreptitiously in the sideboard and half killed himself with eating. He thought it was a judgment upon him for stealing, they were so hot. Emmy wrote a comical little account of this mishap to the major. It pleased him to think that her spirits were rallying, and that she could be merry sometimes now. He sent over a pair of shawls, a white one for her, and a black one with palm leaves for her mother, and a pair of red scarfs, as winter wrappers, for old Mr. Sedley and George. The shawls were worth 50 guineas apiece at the very least, as Mrs. Sedley knew. She wore hers in state at church at Brompton, and was congratulated by her female friends upon the splendid acquisition. Emmy's, too, became prettily her modest black gown. Had a pity it is she won't think of him. Mrs. Sedley remarked to Mrs. Clapp, and to all her friends of Brompton, "Us never sent us such presents, I am sure, and grudges us everything. It is evident that the major is over head and ears in love with her. And yet, whenever I so much as hint it, she turns red, and begins to cry and goes and sits upstairs with her miniature. I'm sick of that miniature. I wish we had never seen those odious purse-proud Osbornes." Amidst such humble scenes and associates, George's early youth was passed, and the boy grew up delicate, sensitive, imperious, woman-bred, domineering the gentle mother whom he loved with passionate affection. He ruled all the rest of the little world round about him. As he grew, the elders were amazed at his haughty manner and his constant likeness to his father. He asked questions about everything, as inquiring youth will do. The profundity of his remarks and interrogatories astonished his old grandfather, who perfectly bored the club at the tavern with stories about the little lad's learning and genius. He suffered his grandmother with a good-humored indifference. The small circle round about him believed that the equal of the boy did not exist upon the earth. George inherited his father's pride, and perhaps thought they were not wrong. When he grew to be about 6 years old, Dobbin began to write to him very much. The major wanted to hear that George was going to a school, and hoped he would acquit himself with credit there. Or would he have a good tutor at home? It was time that he should begin to learn, and his godfather and guardian hinted that he hoped to be allowed to defray the charges of the boy's education, which would fall heavily upon his mother's straitened income. The major, in a word, was always thinking about Amelia and her little boy, and by orders to his agents, kept the latter provided with picture books, paint boxes, desks, and all conceivable implements of amusement and instruction. 3 days before George's 6th birthday, a gentleman in a gig, accompanied by a servant, drove up to Mr. Sedley's house and asked to see Master George Osborne. It was Mr. Woolsey, military tailor, of Conduit Street, who came at the major's order to measure the young gentleman for a suit of clothes. He had had the honor of making for the captain, the young gentleman's father. Sometimes too, and by the major's desire no doubt, his sisters, the Misses Dobbin, would call in the family carriage to take Amelia, and the little boy to drive, if they were so inclined. The patronage and kindness of these ladies was very uncomfortable to Amelia, but she bore it meekly enough, for her nature was to yield, and, besides, the carriage and its splendors gave little Georgie immense pleasure. The ladies begged occasionally that the child might pass a day with them, and he was always glad to go to that fine garden house at Denmark Hill, where they lived, and where there were such fine grapes in the hot houses and peaches on the walls. One day they kindly came over to Amelia with news which they were sure would delight her, something very interesting about their dear William. What was it? Was he coming home? She asked with pleasure beaming in her eyes. Oh, no, not the least, but they had very good reason to believe that dear William was about to be married, and to a relation of a very dear friend of Amelia's, to Miss Glorvina O'Dowd, Sir Michael O'Dowd's sister, who had gone out to join Lady O'Dowd at Madras, a very beautiful and accomplished girl, everybody said. Amelia said H. Amelia was very, very happy indeed. But she supposed Glorvina could not be like her old acquaintance, who was most kind, but she was very happy indeed. And by some impulse of which I cannot explain the meaning, she took George in her arms, and kissed him with an extraordinary tenderness. Her eyes were quite moist when she put the child down, and she scarcely spoke a word during the whole of the drive, though she was so very happy indeed. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.